Chapter 43. 14 Points and an Armistice. In 1918, the United States government landed 2,082,000 soldiers on the continent of Europe. That was double the number of the entire German army on the Russian front. In January, only 195,000 Americans had landed, but 6 months later the number swelled to 1,200,000. In addition to men, the United States poured in material and food. Overnight, the British and the French were being replenished with whatever they had lost, or whatever they needed. In 1917, American bank loans to the Allies had accounted for 95% of United States exports to Europe. The Allied imports were enormous: 5 billion tons of food, 5 billion tons of supplies, and 1.5 billion tons of steel. Ludendorff was aware of the massive American influx, but calculated that he could still outmaneuver the enemy. When Admiral von Hintze, the Kaiser's envoy, asked him whether he could defeat the enemy totally, Ludendorff answered, categorically yes. Within 3 months, Ludendorff had overwhelmed the Allies on three separate occasions with 130 divisions, while he still had 77 in reserve. For the final thrust, he would deploy 2 million men between Reims and the Argonne River. In France, a quiet soldier was waiting for him, General Pétain, who was later to become Marshal and Head of State. Pétain was called the Victor of Verdun because for 6 months he had held the German army in check in the city of Verdun. While Foch was an aggressive general, Pétain was primarily a defensive strategist. He was careful to keep casualties to a minimum. He had noticed how other French generals had tried to hold out in frontline positions only to have their men massacred. He chose to duplicate Hindenburg's strategy. He would secretly abandon his forward positions and build up formidable defenses in the rear. As Pétain knew, Ludendorff would no longer be covered by his artillery once he reached the reinforced rear lines. On July 15, 1918, Ludendorff attacked Pétain with 47 of his 207 divisions. He overran the first lines with the greatest ease, but his heavy artillery had pounded empty terrain. Pétain's artillery was swiftly wheeled back. Pétain's guns met Ludendorff's 1st and 3rd armies with millions of 75mm shells. At first, Ludendorff fell into the trap. His troops advanced 3 miles and crossed the Marne River, but he stopped them going any further. Since the debacle of Château Thierry, Foch realized he had to organize a massive counterattack. In that spirit, he sent no major reinforcements to Pétain's defensive positions. Foch ran the risk of annihilation, but he had decided more out of stubbornness than skill to employ his offensive strategy. On July 18, 1918, he ordered General Mangin to make a frontal attack. It was on that day that the German High Command would make its only major error of the whole war: it underestimated the potential of tanks designed for assault. It is an irony of history that in 1940 and 1941 the German Reich would rout the armies of its opponents all over Europe, thanks to the tanks of the panzer divisions. But in 1917 the German High Command had not yet been convinced of the efficacy of tanks. The British and the French had failed in their first tank offensives, losing half their armor in a hail of artillery fire. In 1918, however, the Allies had built much improved versions. The Allies sent thousands of them, in a continuous wave, until a breach of the Ludendorff front was effected. This time German firepower was not able to stop the flow of new tanks. Mangin advanced 30 miles deep into the German lines and took 12,000 prisoners in 1 day. The German supply lines were overrun as well. Despite this reverse, Ludendorff managed to maintain order and discipline. He organized an orderly redeployment behind Fismes and established a new German front on August 2, 1918 near the River Vesle. The setback was not a major disaster, but for the first time the Germans had lost the initiative. Hindenburg was confident, "Five times during the war I've had to pull back my troops and I always ended up beating the enemy. Why shouldn't I succeed a sixth time?" Ludendorff was also optimistic about his prospects: "The German army will be able to take the initiative again." Ludendorff still had 205 divisions at his disposal. His soldiers were battle-tested and had always displayed the highest bravery and discipline. The Allies conceded they did not have the manpower to match such an enormous and well-organized force. The lack of Allied manpower would soon be remedied by an influx of 1,145,000 American soldiers. By July 1918, the United States had sent 27 divisions to France. 19 of them were combat ready, and the rest could be sent to the front within 4 months. On July 27, Clemenceau sent a telegram to General Pershing, cordial congratulations for the creation of the first American army. History awaits you, you will not fail it. On August 7, 1918, Foch was elevated to Marshal of France. The next day, he stealthily moved his troops towards Amiens. A thick fog veiled his maneuvers. The Germans were surprised by the attack, particularly the number of tanks involved, and were forced to retreat another 10 miles. The Allies now controlled the road from Amiens to Roye. Ludendorff conceded, "This is a black day for the German army." He would wait another 3 days for a complete report to evaluate Germany's chances of victory. "We must face facts and figures. We are at the limit of our strength, the war must end." Ludendorff had said the definitive word. Peace was no longer a wish, it was a necessity. Germany would have to negotiate a peace and agree to compromises. Its bargaining power would be lessened, but would still carry some weight. Germany had lost a battle, but its forces were still in France, while none of the Allied armies were in Germany. Ludendorff had in mind a peace in which the status quo ante bellum, borders and all, would be restored. Since October 1917, many leaders of the West had become concerned at the rise of communism. Lenin had stated that the Bolshevik Revolution would sweep the world, and the intrusion of communist agitators was becoming ever more evident. The Allies were faced with choosing between a policy of conciliation to meet a universal threat or the old policy of secret treaties, expansionism, colonialism, and revenge. The odds were slim that they would opt for conciliation. They had not wanted to hear or talk of peace when they were losing on the battlefield year after year. Now that they had experienced some success, the possibility of peace seemed even more remote. Chancellor Hertling had little understanding of Allied intentions. On September 3, 1918, he told his ministers, "We must say to our enemies, you can see for yourselves that you cannot beat us, but we are ready, as we have been on many occasions before, to conclude an honorable peace." His offer was greeted with derision by the British and the French. They had decided to end the conflict on the battlefield and to crush Germany. After a lull in the fighting, the Allies took the offensive on August 20 and advanced on the Ailette and Cambrai. Hindenburg and Ludendorff were forced to retreat and establish a new front. For Germany, there was yet hope of bringing back its divisions from Russia. If communism was gaining influence across the world, it was not faring so well in Russia itself. Lenin was increasingly challenged by nationalist forces, anti-Bolshevik armies and other hostile elements, which were constantly increasing. In desperation, he decided to sign an accord of cooperation with Germany to free his hands and deal with his internal enemies. The accord allowed for the return of 500,000 German soldiers to the Western Front. But it would take 3 months to move them, and by then it might be too late. The American forces had joined the front and were proving excellent soldiers. Nevertheless, in mid-September, Germany, though weakened, was certainly not defeated. Tardieu noted, "By September 28, 1918, the enemy had lost most of the ground it had won from March to June, but there are still 68 divisions in reserve, representing more than 1 million men. They may be weakened, but so are the Allies." The war continued to inflict massive casualties on both sides. The Kaiser kept repeating, "We must catch the right moment to settle with the enemy." But the time never came. Within 3 weeks, Germany's fortunes turned markedly downwards. Her allies Bulgaria and Austria were defeated, and Turkey capitulated. Germany was now alone in the face of vastly superior forces. Ludendorff showed great heroism, but he just didn't have the numbers. St. Quentin, rulers, and Lille fell and Ludendorff retreated to the Siegfried Line. The Turkish and Bulgarian defections and the warning that Austria would soon capitulate prompted Ludendorff to send a telegram to the German High Command on September 21, "We should make contact with the United States." On October 1, 1918, Ludendorff, somewhat agitated, summoned two liaison officers from the Berlin Chancery to his headquarters. He gave them the following message: "Would you please transmit a pressing demand regarding the immediate dispatching of our peace offer? The troops are holding out today, but one cannot predict what will happen tomorrow." Later, Ludendorff sent a second message: "Our situation is still honorable. An enemy breakthrough, however, can occur at any time, in which case our peace offer would come at the worst time. I have the feeling I am gambling. There is the likelihood that at any time and at any place a division can fail in its duty. In fact, no German division ever failed in its duty. Soldiers and officers alike stood their ground. They waded knee-deep in mud in my native valley of the Semois, and as a young boy I recall witnessing the unshakable German devotion to duty. Sedan remained German right until the day of the armistice." On October 25, 1918, British Marshal Haig confessed to Foch and Pershing that his troops were tired out and the enemy remained extremely tough. "We are exhausted. The units need to be reorganized. Germany is not militarily broken. In the past weeks, German armies have retreated while fighting very bravely and in the best order." Haig's observation was borne out by the facts. On September 20, Ludendorff still had 68 divisions in reserve. In the last hour of the war, 7 were still available, while 139 were on combat duty. Tardieu agreed, "The vigor of the German resistance in critical circumstances was evident until Armistice Day." Peace, page 83. A few days before the armistice, the French military thought they would have to spend another winter at the front. Foch told the House, just 12 days before Compiègne, "I am not in a position and no one is in a position to give you an exact date. The war could last 3 months, maybe 4 or 5, who knows?" Lloyd George also watched the casualties. "Right now each of our armies is losing more men than in any other week during the first 4 years of the war." The war had yielded no victors. Both sides were tired and bloodied. Churchill himself, who was no friend of Germany, admitted publicly that only the great qualities of the German people could have enabled them to maintain a struggle against three-quarters of the world. After 1,500 days and nights of intensive combat, Germany was, at the beginning of 1918, still fighting the Allies well outside its own territory. In October 1918, Germany declared its willingness to cease hostilities on the basis of Wilson's 14 points. The Kaiser had, through third parties, already informed Wilson that Germany would evacuate France and Belgium without conditions. The Kaiser's offer had stood since August 8, 1918, but remained unanswered by the Wilson administration. It would take another 100,000 dead before Wilson acknowledged the German appeal. Ludendorff had advised an end to hostilities, however, when he saw the Allies had ignored the German appeal, he reported, "The German army is still strong enough to contain the enemy for months. It can win localized battles and inflict heavy casualties on the Allies." Marshal Hindenburg likewise told the Reich Chancellor on October 3, 1918, "Although my position is becoming more critical by the day, the German army remains solid and continues to resist all Allied attacks." Unlike Poincaré, who, far from the trenches, screamed for more blood, Hindenburg was a deeply compassionate man. "Each day lost costs the lives of thousands of good men." The old marshal also felt the gravity of communist subversion inside Germany and its link with Petrograd. The communists were waiting for the defeat of the German army to launch an uprising. Already German supply lines were being infiltrated by Red agitators. It was reminiscent of St. Petersburg in March 1917. Although the Soviets had publicly stated their aim to communize the entire world, only Churchill, among all the Allies, took the threat seriously. "The Bolsheviks represent an international conception of human affairs which is totally alien and hostile to all our ideas of civilization. World Crisis, Volume 4, page 18. After 2 months of ignoring the German peace appeals, Wilson finally replied on October 8, 1918. He asked questions which had already been answered by the Germans in their first appeal: does the German government accept the 14 points in their entirety? Will the German government evacuate all occupied territories immediately? Does the German government speak on behalf of the authorities who have waged war until now? On October 11, 1918, the German Reich replied. Germany agreed to everything. The new government, approved by absolute majority, speaks in the name of the German people. On October 14, Wilson sent a second note demanding the destruction of all German military power and the transformation of German political institutions. William II knew what it meant. This aims squarely at the removal of the monarchy. Despite Ludendorff's strong opposition, he resigned in October 26. The government, headed by Prince von Baden, gave in to all demands, in the name of the German people. On October 28, 1918, Wilson sent a third note demanding an armistice whereby it would be impossible for Germany to take up arms. The armistice and peace, Wilson cabled, could only be negotiated with representatives of the German people and not with those who have ruled the people until now. Once more the German government agreed. When Ludendorff protested on behalf of the Germany army, the new vice-chancellor, Peyer, replied curtly, "I know nothing of military honor, I am just a wicked bourgeois, just a civilian." Such talk made the German socialists feel that their time was coming at last. The socialists, wrote historian Mark Farrow, were calling the tune. They were in power and were waiting for Chancellor von Baden to obtain Wilhelm II's abdication. They pressured him to resign, implying that a revolution would follow. The predictions of revolution were not idle talk. On November 3, 1918, the first mutinies would occur in Kiel. Before resigning, Ludendorff had stated on October 25, "If the army holds out another 4 weeks, and winter sets in, we will be out of the woods." Undersecretary Solf then asked point blank, "If a refusal to comply with Wilson's demands breaks the negotiations, will you take the responsibility for it?" "Yes," replied Ludendorff. Hindenburg also opposed Wilson's demands. "It would be better to keep on fighting and save our honor." The Allies realized they could still break their teeth on the German bone. They were bent on a war of attrition. For his part, Wilson was learning, after Germany had agreed to all his demands, that it was in his own camp that peace was not wanted. The Allies had no time for his kind of peace, in which the British would no longer rule the seas, and where French, Italian, Greek and Central European politicians could not tear at Germany like jackals after the war. On October 3, 1918, Wilson decided to ask the Allies whether they were disposed to conclude peace under the conditions and principles already known. Wilson was, of course, referring to his 14 points, which particularly stressed peace without annexations. The points had been read in Congress on January 8, 1918. Open conventions openly arrived at. For the previous 3 years, the Allies had signed, in the utmost secrecy, a series of conventions for the purpose of sharing the spoils of war. Absolute freedom of navigation upon the seas. Britain had not the slightest willingness to abide by such a point. Abolition of as many economic barriers as possible and the establishment of commercial conditions for all nations. The French government wanted just the opposite in order to keep Germany down forever. Arms in each country will be reduced to a minimum. The Allies wanted to keep their superiority of arms but wanted Germany totally disarmed. Concerning colonies, the interests of the populations concerned will carry the same weight as colonial claims. The Allies had already confiscated German colonies for themselves and had no intention of asking the natives what they thought about it. Evacuation of all Russian territory. The Allies agreed to this point. Lenin, who had been contained in a narrow corner of Russia, was now unleashed to spread communism throughout the world. Belgium must be evacuated and restored. Everybody agreed. The wrongs caused to France by Prussia in 1871 in relation to Alsace-Lorraine must be righted. This point was subject to multiple interpretations. A rectification of Italian borders must be effected in accordance with the principle of nationality. This point was negated by the secret Treaty of London signed by Britain, France, and Italy in 1915. The treaty ignored the principle of nationality, since it promised the Italians South Tyrol, including 240,000 German inhabitants. Autonomous development of the people of Austria and Hungary. In 1919, the two countries would be encircled by a band of states controlled by the Allies. This remapping of Central Europe was done without the consent of its millions of German, Hungarian, and Slovak inhabitants. International guarantees for the independence and integrity of Romania, Serbia, and Montenegro. This point was vague and did nothing to solve long-standing historical issues. Concerning the nations under Turkish rule, mostly Arab, full security and the right to independent development without any interference. This point was illusory. In a secret treaty with France, the British had given themselves the lion's share of the Middle East, which included territories, populations, and oil. Furthermore, the British establishment had promised the Arab country of Palestine to the Jews of the world. The Palestinians were, of course, never consulted. An independent Polish state will be created, which will comprise territories inhabited by Polish populations and which will be given free access to the sea. The word access was understood by the Allies as meaning annexation, and the point failed to mention that the territories inhabited by Polish populations were also inhabited by more than 10 million non-Polish people. The establishment of a General Association of Nations. The Allies regarded this point as just another of Wilson's grand ideas of no relevance or future. Should the Germans have refused to go along with Wilson's 14 points? Like most other Europeans, they had no knowledge of Wilson's physical and psychological state. A man debilitated by illness can often be harmful to others. He is betrayed and irritated by his body. His character is affected, and so is his range of actions. Wilson had been sick and ailing since childhood. His eyes, his stomach, his bowels, and his nervous system were affected by illness. His biographer, Bullitt, wrote, "At 70 years of age, he was suffering from gastric problems, migraines, nervous disorders, and stomach troubles." President Wilson, page 264. Freud later diagnosed him as suffering from typical nervous depression and noted his paranoiac reflexes, particularly in his belief that he was the reincarnated Christ. Although he did not set out to cause trouble, his absolute belief that he could do no wrong boded ill for humanity. He believed his higher principles would change human nature and the world, but his physical and mental condition made him unaware that he was being manipulated by intriguers and conspirators, both inside and outside America. The First World War was above all an imperialist war. The objectives were strictly material and territorial. No one was fighting, as in 1940, for ideals or a new concept of world order, but to quench a thirst for more trade, more people, and more land. This greed for gain would soon submerge Wilson in Versailles, where his hopes for a better world would be forever dashed. He may have realized then that politics is the graveyard of good intentions. The Germans, lacking British political cynicism, had decided to go along with Wilson's 14 points. They were not concerned that some conditions were overly severe, because they believed their near victory in the summer of 1918 would ensure them an honorable peace. They had been impressed by certain conciliatory statements Wilson had made concerning Germany. "We are in a way jealous of German greatness, and there is nothing in our program to thwart it." Wilson had also taken a number of public stands on Germany. "We know now that we are not the enemy of the German people and they are not ours. They did not start nor wish this horrible conflict. We did not want to be drawn into it either, but we feel that we are in a way fighting for the German people, and one day they will realize it, as much as for ourselves." A most moving declaration. The Germans, however, would have placed less reliance on it if they had heard Wilson's previous comments, this time speaking as a true politician, to the effect that, "We must not attach too much importance to promises." What would remain of Wilson's promises a year later? The Allies viewed the 14 points as a threat to the gains they had already made. For diplomatic reasons, they had not publicly opposed them, but they were far from agreeing to them. Wilson meant to impose them, one way or another. If the Allies failed to recognize the sacredness of his principles, he would bring them to reason by financial pressure. Britain and France, he wrote to House, do not have the same ideas as we have concerning peace. After the war, we will be able to force them to think like us, because among other things, they will be in our hands financially. Bullet, President Wilson, page 306, 319. The Allies, who were still unsure of winning the war, went through the motions of placating Wilson. Privately, they were seething, and feared a premature armistice would undermine their latest battlefield gains. They needed American troops to ensure total victory on their terms. Wilson's messianic liberalism made for a poor performance in public relations and diplomacy. He treated opposition to his ideas with disbelief and contempt. Unbelievers would be financially arm-twisted or bypassed. This attitude led him to negotiate the conditions of the November 11th armistice without even consulting the various pressure groups controlling the politics of America. He ignored the traditional American way of seeking consensus through consultation and bipartisan compromise. The Republicans were not invited to be associated with his 14 points, despite Wilson's demands being presented as a national plan and policy. Wilson would go to Versailles embroiled in a bitter and sordid political fight. He would not be the spokesman of a united America, he would pursue his own policy and visions. Further, his ill-advised attempt to impose 10 candidates of his own choice in an upcoming senatorial election backfired. 8 of the 10 Wilson-picked candidates lost by a landslide. It was a stinging rebuff that did little to enhance his prestige or credibility on the eve of his departure for France. Apart from losing face at home and abroad, Wilson also lost control of the Senate. Without Senate approval, Wilson lacked the power to commit America to an international treaty such as that of Versailles. Everything he would sign would be at the mercy of a hostile Congress. Congress would indeed reject the treaty which Wilson had signed at Versailles. The armistice with Germany was signed on November 11, 1918. The treaty negotiations would start in January 1919, but they were doomed to failure from the outset. Each participant observed the usual diplomatic niceties, but before the first session ever started, there was scarcely a single issue generally agreed on by the Allies. Wilson, who had been so bent on imposing his point of view, no longer had a majority in his own country. In a rare flash of realism, Wilson expressed doubts as to the results of the Versailles Treaty. "This will cost us thousands of lives and billions of dollars, just to end in an infamous peace which will condemn us to another and worse war than this one." Bullet, President Wilson, page 297. Behind the lights and applause, which were dazzling a gullible public, the greatest failure in history was taking shape.